Hello and welcome to another episode of The Philosophy Guy. So today, by demand of the audience, I'm getting into some interviews. So this is my first interview, and also it's going to be a political-based interview. So basically what I want to ask you, the audience, is your feedback. I'm trying to get back in the role of doing interviews again, so we'll see how this, what you think of it. And then also, I want to get some feedback on guests that you would like to have on, because I'll start inviting people on. I'm going to, like I said, interviews will be occasional. I don't know how often I'm going to do them, but I'm still going to do a lot of solo episodes, but it's going to be a mix of both. I like to have my show as kind of like this a la carte of content options and content styles and stuff like that. So yeah, this is a new content style that I'm starting with the new year and doing interviews. I'm going to do political stuff. I'm going to do kind of stuff about more consciousness-based and kind of the more kind of spirituality-based and also philosophically-based, all sorts of stuff that basically the interviews are going to relate to my solo content in this, in that sense of trying to like get you to think differently about the world, right? So today's guest is going to be Ben Burgess, and he is a philosophy professor at Georgia State University. And he's the author of Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left. And he's a regular weekly contributor to Jacobin Magazine. I don't know if I just mispronounced that. Jacobin Magazine. And he does a regular weekly segment on the Michael Brooks Show called The Debunk. So, yeah, he's all over the interwebs. You can find various debates. And I read his book, and everyone should check it out, even if you are not on the left. I think it's kind of interesting just to consider his arguments and, you know, the base of the show is to think about the world, right? So yeah, anyway, check that stuff out. Check him out. Check out the links below. I'll have linked up some stuff to his book and his Twitter and all that good stuff. But anyway, I hope you enjoy the interview. And yeah, we will talk next time. Yeah, we can just kind of see where it goes. Like I said, I'm getting back into interviews, so we'll see how well I keep the conversation going. Sure. But yeah, I guess let's just start with kind of what inspired you to, I guess the best way to phrase it is start making arguments for the left from a philosophical lens, because that's kind of why I brought you on, is because my audience has kind of wanted me to get into the political side of things. So I've been kind of looking for various people that look to focus on the philosophical lens of the political issues. And that's when I stumbled upon your book and some of your debates on YouTube. So yeah, kind of what your motivation is, and then also kind of what the style is and the importance of it.
Sure. So, I mean, for me, the political interests and philosophy were always, for the most part, on separate tracks. So, I certainly had, you know, roughly the political commitments that I have before, you know, I had any thought of like going to graduate school or anything like that. When I did do all those things, you know, I didn't primarily focus on political philosophy. You know, was doing like very abstract kind of logic choppy, you know, analytic philosophy stuff.
Right.
You know, so like my dissertation was about logic and the liar paradox. But I had been for kind of a few years drifting back in the direction of wanting to be more to be more involved in, you know, things, everything that was, you know, had been going on, sort of probably, you know, probably from about Occupy Wall Street to especially, you know, that's kind of when I sort of started feeling that itch more, you know, to like a lot of people, the Sanders campaign in 2016, you know, energized me a lot. And I joined the DSA then, and, you know, was very active in that. But then kind of combining the two streams, you know, because like you can find, you know, like you can still find some articles that I wrote for Counterpunch on political topics from like 2015, 2016 online. And, you know, I really wasn't, you know, and I really wasn't relating very much of what I was doing at that point to philosophical arguments or anything like that. So really, combining the two is mostly kind of happenstance. So I'd been writing a book that's sort of loosely based on my dissertation called Logic Without Gaps or Gluts: How to Solve the Paradox Without Sacrificing Classical Logic. And I've been posting about it a lot online. And my friend Doug Lane, who edits Zero Books, I think because he saw me post about that all the time, you know, it was like, I wrote a little bit more of the logic book today, whatever. Then he kind of asks, like, hey, would you be interested in writing something for us? And, you know, like maybe about like logic and politics. And I didn't really see what he meant at first. But then, like, the more I kind of wrapped my mind around that, you know, the more excited I got about it. And then, like, actually, it seemed to me since then that there's a real unfilled niche there. That there's a lot of you know, there are a lot of people who are really there's a kind of hunger for sort of like really like intellectually substantive arguments about this stuff, and certainly. Certainly a lot of people on the left, having been told for so long that, you know, they're by a certain kind of right winger, certainly that, you know, that they're just like sort of soft headed and guided by their feelings, you know. You know, like there's certainly a lot of people who enjoy the idea of actually like being able to show is like, no, you're actually like, you know, you're actually wrong on the arguments and here's why, and, you know, being able to kind of play that game. But like, I think there's also more generally a lot of interest in more sort of intellectual substance to political arguments. I think that's kind of where, you know, some of the people that like I've spent, you know, that I've like even some of the right wing figures have spent the most time arguing against. I think that's where part of the, you know, the appeal comes from. Like somebody like Jordan Peterson. I think one of the reasons that he's like hyper popular is that people have a sense that he's like, that he's not just, you know, even when he's, you know, ranting about pronouns or whatever, that like he's got a sense that he's got a perspective that's like rooted and like having thought really deeply about like big issues about, you know, existential meaning and things like that. And, you know, and people want that. And if, you know, and if they can't, you know, if they can't get it from the left, they're going to get it from, you know, elsewhere in the political spectrum. You know, I guess it's like, you know, I guess it's like the sort of old like kind of 1950s argument for sex ed. You know, if they don't get it in school, they'll learn it on the streets, right?
Right. That's actually a good point. Yeah. Yeah. And I think Jordan Peterson actually tapped into something where, because like he kind of attracts a very, even, I would even say like a centrist left base as well. And it's kind of interesting. It's like he does give off that persona, like where even if people disagree with him, for example, he still, like you said, they like see this appearance that he's thought really deeply about it. So they're going to like tune in anyway. And it gives him that kind of, I don't know what the word is, like it's academic feel to it. Like they're learning something, which, like I said, people can disagree with Jordan Peterson, but we can at least observe what he's tapping into. And I think branching off of that, there's other various niches that people can fill, which I think you've kind of started to fill as well. for the left, and kind of like what I want to bring it into, because you brought it up. For example, Ben Shapiro, he talks about where the right has the facts on their side and all that, and the left makes the emotional arguments. So I guess let's bring this into play, devil's advocate, to raise a question. Does the left make more emotional arguments? Like, what are what's like a synopsis of some arguments that the left can make against the right, against people like Ben Shapiro, who phrase it that way as though they're the fact king? And then you have all those videos of Ben Shapiro taking down some innocent freshman in college.
Well, I mean, this is why the cover image on the book drawn by my friend Ryan Lake, who does the philosophy web comic Chaos Pet, is of Ben Shapiro starting to say facts don't care about your feelings and being hushed by David Hume, who talks, you know, and there's a, you know, and it's funny, you know, there's a deeper point there, which is that all moral and political arguments ultimately rely on some sort of appeal to what Hume would call the moral sentiments, right? You know, that that you can't that the facts, right? Like, I mean, if I mean, I don't necessarily want to get into the, you know, meta ethics, whether they're moral facts, whatever. Not that, you know, that's not interesting, but I think it's a different discussion, right?
Yeah, right.
But the facts, you know, the non-moral facts, right? Presumably, what we're talking about, right? You know, the empirical facts, you know, can tell us how to. Could be very relevant to arguments about how to achieve the goals that we care about, right? You know, that factual information can certainly do that, right? You know, that we can, you know, we can see what's worked and what hasn't worked and everything, but it can't tell us what we should care about in the first place, mm-hmm. right? You know, that, so that's what, you know, this is Hume's point about the fact value gap that we, that, you know, it can't, like, there's no way to go from here are a bunch of scientific facts to here are the things that we should value, you know, and so like, for example, in Shapiro's case, if you watch, there's a classic or kind of an instant classic interview with him from last year from the BBC when he was promoting his new book, The Right Side of History, How Reason and Moral Purpose Made the West Great, I think is the subtitle.
Yeah.
And he was being interviewed by Andrew Neil, who is actually like a extremely conservative. He's like a really like old fashioned kind of like aristocratic high Tory, you know, but he's also a BBC interviewer, so he, you know, he doesn't ask softball questions. Mm-hmm. And Shapiro ended up getting, you know, really upset about the whole thing. But like, there's a point in there where Neil is asking him about these really harsh new anti-abortion laws that were passed in Georgia, and ask him to defend those. And Shapiro sort of said, "Well, you know, it's science, right? You know, that the that, you know, human life, you know, begins at conception." And of course, in a certain sense, that's true, right? You know, that they, that if we're strict, if we strictly mean, you know, like if we're not using human life as a stand-in for some concept like personhood or moral rights, right? But like, mm-hmm. we literally just mean human life, then sure, that's actually totally uncontroversial, right? Nobody,
right.
Literally nobody denies that. It's not like people have pro-choice positions because they think that, you know, fetuses start out having raccoon DNA and then they only gradually start to have human DNA, right? That,
right.
Of course, that's something that's checks the biological boxes for life and is genetically human and all that stuff. But the real question is a value question, or really a whole cluster of value questions. Like, do we think that anything that's alive and genetically human has life, has value because of that? Do we only think that, you know, that things have value, have this moral value because they're persons? Do we, even if we do think that a fetus has, you know, has some sort of moral value, to give it a you know, at least prima facie right to life, then how's that weighed against, you know, woman's you know, moral right to bodily autonomy, right? You know, and none of those questions does science say anything about, right? You know, like right. those are just, you know, those aren't empirical questions. And so I'd say that that you can't, if you don't have you know, in order to success, you know, like, you know, in order to figure out how to implement the moral and political goals that you care about, right? You know, you certainly need to appeal to facts, but you just wouldn't be in the business of making moral and political arguments in the first place if there weren't feelings that were ultimately driving it. And that's going to be just as true. That's going to be just as true on all sides. And actually, even though people like that use these phrases like logic, facts, and reason, you know, almost as like, you know, incantations, you know, it is a principle of good reasoning, right? You know, that you can't get an ought conclusion from pure is premises. So I think that that's all a way of saying, like, yeah, go ahead, you know, don't feel bad about like caring about moral principles, because if you didn't, you just wouldn't be in the business of arguing about this stuff in the first place. Both sides care about moral principles. They just disagree about the moral principles. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly cases where you can say that there's a that, you know, people, you know, leftists are, you know, making, you know, like that there's some like common leftist argument that's a bad argument, or, you know, that like I'm even fine with saying that that there are cases in which you know, you people will come to certain conclusions because they're, you know, they can't sort of calm down in the moment, right? Sort of think through what they're saying. But that doesn't mean that the right way to do this is to retreat from moral sentiment, retreat from like feel from feelings as the sort of guiding principles, because you can't, because if you, you know, there is no, you know, it's not that that would lead you towards the ideal moral and political conclusions. That just wouldn't lead you towards any moral or political conclusions at all.
Yeah, because it's like the right kind of like you said, they use the terms commonly. Ben Shapiro crowd, especially, they use the terms like logic and facts and all that stuff, and they use that as almost like a placeholder as an argument, as though like saying those words is like all of a sudden becomes their argument. Yeah. And then they kind of also, which I agree with you, is the right seems to still believe, and luckily I think as like a culture. People are starting to accept this a little bit more, just because, you know, I guess scientific information has come out, and the role that people realize that emotions and cognitive biases play with us. For example, we're starting to realize that our reason isn't this kind of perfect thing. Yeah. Like all of a sudden, like you can just reason your way perfectly. You have no outside influences. You can just look at the facts and interpret exactly what you're supposed to, all this type of stuff. And I think people are finally starting to accept that. And the right, I feel like, needs to accept that, because, like you said, feelings and reason are constantly intermixing. And we can't extract pure feelings, and we also can't just extract with just pure reason. And I think that's like an important distinction. Like to kind of relate it back to like what you're trying to say, I want to get into, because the value idea, mm-hmm. and the moral facts idea. And let's like, yeah. kind of, let's try to make it on the political side of things, because I think it's kind of like the easiest to digest for people, in the sense that, do you think the left and the right, and even the center, I guess you could say, there's a lot of groupings we can discuss. Do they share similar values? Because I know that's like, it's become in the kind of Jordan Peterson world of kind of mainstream academic stuff, the discussion of these kind of, do we share values, whether we don't even need to get into discussion of like objective and subjective, just do we share values to some extent?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, certainly. But I also think that it's often the case that there seems to be more agreement on the value questions, like kind of on first glance, than there is when you really start to dig into it. And in fact, I think what a lot of political persuasion is persuading people that, like, when you kind of take a second look, there's, you know, these two things that, like, seem like they maybe amount to the same thing, right? Really yeah. don't. And once we sort of pry them apart, you see that, like, no, like, well, I mean, just to, you know, I don't want this to be too abstract, to, like, have a specific example, something nearly everybody would say that they value freedom, right? That would be very, like, that would be very odd and surprising, you know, if somebody said they didn't care about that. But then when you sort of look into, like, what, like, a hardcore libertarian really means when they throw around, you know, this word freedom, it's something very narrow and specific that, you know, that has a lot to do with property rights. If the government here's a really, like, really concrete example, right? So, I remember reading Rick Perlstein's book. He's a historian who talks about the rise of the sort of modern conservative movement. And through he's got a book about the Barry Goldwater campaign called Before the Storm, and one called Nixonland, and one called The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon, The Rise of Reagan. Anyway, it was one of those three books. They're all jumping together for me. He quotes an observer in, you know, like 1964, talking about how, like, civil rights protesters and Goldwaterites, you know, both constantly invoked this word freedom, right? Mm-hmm. But then, like, you know, what they meant by it was really almost the opposite, right? Like, because for the, like, you know, the Goldwater people were opposed to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 for the same reason that Rand Paul said, you know, a few years ago, that, you know, that he would have been against it, which is that it violates the property rights of business owners. That if the government is coercively coming in and saying that you have to take that whites only sign out of the restaurant window, then that's violated their freedom. Whereas what the civil rights protesters meant by freedom was, like, the sort of ability of, you know, Black Americans to, you know, to sort of navigate their way through the sort of normal, the sort of life in America without, you know, without encountering race-based obstacles, right? You know, so from that perspective, freedom, you know, was definitely enhanced by, you know, by telling restaurant owners that they weren't allowed to have whites only signs in the window. I think in that case, there's certainly some overlap with, you know, and even though that example, you know, there are relatively few people now other than Rand Paul, I guess, who would still defend the Goldwater position. But I think there are a lot of examples that kind of parallel that, right? Everybody values freedom, and maybe we mean some of the same things by it, right? Mm-hmm. But I think there's an important sense in which different conceptions of it really come apart, and really people who are, you know, who might sort of find the libertarian conception appealing and who are persuadable, right, which not everybody is, of course, probably one of the most, you know, one of the ways which they can be persuaded is realizing that the conception of freedom that all this is premised on isn't really the one that they care about on reflection. Hmm.
Yeah, so to kind of, like, extend off that and maybe play slightly devil's advocate.
Yeah.
So, like, So I guess maybe the best way to make the distinction is, because like libertarians, for example, are mm-hmm. very into kind of the freedom to, and then mm-hmm. where, you know, let's say someone more on the left would be the, like freedom from, right? It's kind of like that distinction.
And, or maybe the other way around.
Or yeah, sorry, the other way around. Yeah. You're exactly yeah. right. Yeah. Anyway, so like the other way around.
I gotcha.
Yeah. But you get what I mean. So from that, at the end of the day, like we can like agree that those are like different means to achieve freedom, for example. But mm-hmm. like let's say like the end goal, like the value, I'm trying to like think of an example off the top of my head, but mm-hmm. let's say like the freedom ends up creating, they both kind of agree that freedom that they envision ends up creating a more, let's just say kind of abstract, but let's kind of go with it, a more just society where, or it creates more prosperity and people end up having better outcomes, that type of thing. So do you think that would end up creating this more similar values? And do you think that is an important distinction to make? Because my overall like purpose for making this devil's advocate position is I do think there is something to this idea that whether we disagree on certain values or ways to achieve certain values, I think it does say something that we agree as like humans to some extent mm-hmm. that we have similar values. And I think that might say something. So kind of what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I'm sure that we do. There are going to be some things that that we all agree on, and maybe they're, you know, maybe like when you sort of get down to this, you know, justice is an interesting example, right? Because like where my mind immediately goes when I hear that is like this sort of like the automatic like word association game, like completion of the sentence is justice as fairness, right? You know, so that's mm-hmm. That's certainly something that wouldn't be in the overlap, but like maybe there's some like underlying conception of justice that's so like abstract that there really is no disagreement on it, right? We're only having disagreements about what would like constitute, you know, justice in that sense, not about mm-hmm. like, not about justice itself. Sort of the way that some people think that I'm not going to dwell on this example because this is like super duper abstract, but like, you know, in people who are pluralists about truth, you know, think there are like different senses in which, you know, like that maybe in different like domains of like reasoning, you know, there are different things that, you know, truth is correspondence to reality in some, or, you know, something else mm-hmm. in others or whatever, but they'll still often say that there's some like sort of overall notion, right?
Right.
That all these things count as examples of, and you know, I'm not like, I don't know that I have a view one way or the other about whether that's true for something like a final conception of justice, but I am a little skeptical about how much it's going to matter politically. Mm-hmm. Because I think that, in fact, I know I'm in sort of a weird position here because I'm sort of telling telling my friends and comrades on the left to sort of care more about getting the reasoning right. But at the same time, in a big picture sense, I don't really accept this idea that like we're all trying to like go the same place and we're just like, you know, we're just like have different ideas about, you know, how to get there, right? You know, that it's mm-hmm. that it's like it's all ultimately just a matter of people who, you know, who want, you know, broadly want the same things, right? You know, mm-hmm. but don't agree about how to get there. I think that some political arguments are like that, right? You know, like if people are I don't know. This is all. I feel like this is already a slightly dated example, you know. I feel like a couple of years ago, I was seeing a lot of people who like broadly agreed on a lot of the same policy goals, having arguments about like a federal jobs guarantee versus a universal basic income, right? You know, that was a big, big debate that was happening then. And I don't know. I think maybe a lot of those people, the UBI was soured a little bit by its association with the Yang Gang and all that. But but in that case, right, in that sort of debate, right, like okay, here's another one, right, like where I think that it really is like that, like and like there's a like if you look at the sort of debate between like somebody like Adolf Reed on the one hand and somebody like Ta-Nehisi Coates on the other about reparations, you know, whether sort of the best way to close the racial wealth gap is with like targeted race specific reparations, or whether whether the best way is to build a much broader coalition that you can build around like universal social democratic programs that will in turn disproportionately benefit the people who are the worst off right now, you know, who are the same people who would be getting the reparations, right? Like that's a debate where I think that like both sides of it really do want the same things. And, you know, for the most, you know, there might be some like different values playing some role in the debate, but I think broadly speaking, right, they really want the same things, and they're arguing about how to get there, how best to realize that the same kind of egalitarian, you know, vision. But I don't believe that the sort of broader debate between like you know, between say conservatives and libertarians, you know, on the one end, and you know, leftists like, you know, social democrats and socialists on the other, about, you know, economic inequality, say, right, you know, I don't believe that's like that, right? I think that's a matter of a really deep divergence in values, which I think has a lot to do with divergence in material interests, you know, people who benefit, and you know, that's actually in a way saying that like, you know, that does, you know, all right, so like even if there's some divergence in material interest at the base of the whole thing, that it goes through that difference in values is in a way like giving people their due, right? You know, because I'm not saying that, you know, that anybody's like consciously malevolent or anything like that, you know, but like, right. I do think that that people who benefit from systems and this goes back to a lot of the cognitive biases and everything you were talking about earlier, right? You know, like are going to be very good at convincing themselves that this is how things should be. And of course, they're not just going to be good at convincing themselves of that. They're also going to be good at convincing a lot of other people about that because they need to, because otherwise, you know, if, you know, no system can survive without, this is Hume's paradox, right? How is it that like, so, you know, like in all countries, right, relatively few people can rule over so many, right? You know, that or, you know, it's the starting point for like Gramsci too, right? You know, that if like, you know, if most people like don't on some level accept the legitimacy of the way things are, then things aren't going to be that way for very long, right? You know, if most serfs don't accept feudalism as like God's will or whatever, you know, then you're not going to have feudalism for very long because they're not going to put up with it.
It's like it's like that old stat. I don't know what they used to say. It's like 7% of the population is all that needs to basically be upset with the way the system's going to really get something going and change the system.
So it's like, yeah, you're going to have overwhelming, like, at any given time, right? You know, it's, you know, you're going to have an overwhelming number of people who, even if they have mixed feelings or complicated attitudes, or is it like basically accept that like it's okay, or even the stuff that's not okay, it's like, it's something like, it's like complaining about the weather, you know, like this is just the way things are.
Yeah. And so like to kind of somewhat stick to the values idea, and this isn't even necessarily like devil's advocate, I wanted to like kind of bring it into, because I think groupings play an interesting role in this like idea around values where people, I think we can easily agree, and I think most people will agree that the political discussions and policy for, let's just say like policy, for example, various policy positions, it's very complex. There's a lot of data being gathered. We live in a society that's they value data a lot. Like people want to base their reasoning on some sort of data, not saying that they do, but, and not saying it's like always the best case. Cause I think we can agree philosophically, we want to understand what our goals are, our intentions are, our values are. Right.
Yeah.
But to like branch off of that, I think people do group themselves into various, and politics is just the easy one, cause it's the one people are most active in general. And people like to associate themselves with a certain group. And I think they immediately, that creates this cognitive bias. But like, this is where maybe the devil's advocate's coming in, is I think within those groups, like maybe sometimes, and this is not all the time, because I think I do agree with you to some extent, where there is agreement there on values, but there's something about the political groupings and those titles that people like to use, because it's simplified, it's nice and packaged for them, it's more easily digestible, and then all of a sudden they see these separations where they don't always exist. And I think one example maybe we can get into, let's say like libertarians, for example.
Yeah.
Because libertarians, you know, there's a lot of them on the right, but there's also some very kind of left-leaning libertarians. And I think the easy example, and I might bring up another one too, we'll see where this one goes. But I think the idea of justice, for example, in the criminal justice system, I think that libertarians and the left agree on a lot. And that's just like one policy example, one kind of value example, because they see this idea of justice around like the government shouldn't be throwing people in prison for nonviolent crimes, for example. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a similar value there. And then like branching off of that, using libertarians again, because I think sometimes libertarians are this kind of like nice little, I don't want to call them like in the center, but they kind of have this ability to play both sides on certain issues being a key point. So, and one example is one bringing up the left libertarians, I think they would see income inequality as an issue where they would see, for example, corporations as these corrupt entities that the left would very much agree with. And I think a lot of left libertarians would agree with. And to me, like there's my overall point is with even within these groups, these kind of oversimplified groups, you have Marxists, you have progressives, you have like a centrist left, you have conservative, you have libertarians, left libertarians. Within those groups, when we get down to it, I think a lot of it maybe is the fact that we try to oversimplify it, and it creates these appearances of value divides when really, when we get like down into the individual issues, there might be more agreement there on various values. Not to say all of them, but there's more agreement there than maybe we realize. So maybe, what do you think about that idea?
Yeah. Sure. So it's certainly going to be true for the most like I guess libertarians is an interesting example too, because there's a, you know, we want to make also probably a distinction there between the most sort of hardcore like relatively internally consistent, like extremely ideological libertarians, and which I think there really aren't very many of, and what there are a lot more of, which are, you know, the sort of like pollster category libertarians, right? You know, who like that sort of, you know, like what they, you know, like there's just like, you know, some like mainstream Republican politicians will say, I've got a libertarian streak or whatever, right? You know, they have and like, you know, there's the sort of, there are people who, and there are lots of people who are maybe in that sort of, well, I don't know about a lot, but, you know, certainly relatively speaking, right? You know, that mm-hmm. like who might sort of fit into that broad like set of policy preferences and be and the reason I think it's important to make that distinction in this case is that, like, I think you're sort of like a relatively ordinary person, like libertarian in the pollster category sense, you know, kind of person is often less likely to have those sort of you know, those better, you know, positions. Like okay, so like for example, people who are like really like strict, like, you know, people who are like, you're really like sort of they've read their Murray Rothbard, you know, books, you know, cover to cover multiple times, mm-hmm. you know, like kind of like really like really into it, relatively consistent libertarians, are tend to be like very, are like very, very anti-war. Right. So that's like a definite point of commonality they have, with leftists. But I think a lot of people who are sort of like, you know, libertarians in the more common sense, you know, don't necessarily have that view, which says something interesting, which I think might just be that, that like people who are like really like ideologues, of any kind, right, are relatively rare, you know, I mean, and like, that's not a diss on libertarianism. Some of the libertarians, you know, I'm one too, right? You know, like I have a, like, right. You know, and most, and I think people who aren't like, don't get their politics from like reading and thinking about books, you know, in the way that like, the really consistent libertarians do, tend to gravitate more towards sort of conservatism light, right? You know, because I think that's the, you know, that's, and there's a reason that I think there's more of a constituency for that, because even if it's maybe less ideologically consistent, it's more sort of coheres with the self-interests of, you know, of a certain kind of segment of the population, you know, maybe like you're sort of, you know, person who might be a small business owner or at least dreams of becoming one, right? You know, whereas the really, you know, like if you're just sort of like really trying to like take these like abstract ideological axioms and see what comes of them, then like, you know, whatever, that's great. Sometimes really good stuff comes from them, right? You know, that there's that, as you know, your example, right? That they're very against mass incarceration and, you know, and you know, anti-war and all this stuff. And that's great, right? Like, and, you know, and you should definitely, I'm all for, and, you know, like, the more, you know, the more people, with different perspectives who are, you know, who are on those pages, the more likely it is, you know, that, they will be able to, we'll be able to do something about them. But I also don't know that it's really that helpful to say, whether it's really a matter of like saying that like, oh, you know, we're blindsided by these sort of political identities that, you know, once you really get down to issues, we have more in common. Like, I think that's true in some ways. But it's also, I don't know. I mean, like, I think that there is definitely some truth to that, right? That people will sort of like, you know, tribally identify with like their team in a way that will lead them to really disregard what they would otherwise think, you know, about specific issues. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you know, I mean, well, I mean, like, you know, Democrats, you know, who were outraged about civil liberties during the Bush administration and kind of gave it a pass during the Obama administration. And, you know, maybe now we're sort of back to caring about that. And, or Republicans who were all about the, rhetoric of, you know, who are all about fear-mongering about Russia, you know, right up until it became the partisan line of it, you know, switch. So I certainly think that those things happen, but I also don't necessarily think that, like, if we could all just stop having group identities and, like, sort of evaluate everything a la carte, right? Mm-hmm. That would necessarily make us, you know, smarter or better about this stuff. Cause I actually do think that there's a sort of, you know, that there's a through line, right? You know, through like, through the, both the sort of economic, positions that leftists typically care about, and also the sort of you know, social liberalism that usually goes with that, right? I don't think that's just historically contingent or anything, right? You know, I think those things are really deeply related. For people on my who see things my way to continue, you know, to see those things as related, and I prefer for more conservatives to care less about team identity and, you know, and start evaluating things one at a time more.
Yeah, and like, the reason I brought this up is because, and this is gonna be an anecdotal example, and maybe this is why I'm like fascinated with this idea, is because, like, for me, I don't like really associate with political terms anymore. Talking about politics here today, it's kind of like a new thing I'm trying, just based on audience demand. But the reason I like brought it up is because, so like, to kind of backtrack, what I like used to see, and I used to be definitely involved in this because my first kind of intro into philosophy was political philosophy, because I wanted to use it to like basically argue for political positions. Mm-hmm. And I like associated with like a, you know, a term, and then all of a sudden you having discussions, and the reason I find it, and maybe we disagree a little bit, but I don't know, we can always find truth and agreement here, but the people that are basically out having these discussions, like let's say me and you even, or let's say debates on YouTube, not saying like that's what people are getting all their political information from, but the people that are like actively trying to discuss this stuff on a mainstream level, they typically associate with these terms. And what I like started noticing was, and I was doing this too, this is why, like I said, I'm going to use like my anecdotal example, but people start like having a discussion in almost like a separate reality, is the way I like look at it, where, you know, they start debating about what real socialism is, what real libertarianism is, real conservatism, real Marxism. And they don't really, and not that I want debates to really like focus on the terms all the time, because that gets really boring, and talking about semantics the whole time is not a discussion everyone wants to listen to. But to some extent it does matter, because then they do just start talking past each other, and they do just start having, and I'm like, I'm all for having abstract conversations, but they do end up just talking about these really like kind of abstract ideas of like utopias, political utopias that they want to achieve and they want to live in, they want to have. But yet when you get down to it, it's like it becomes these groupings again, where they're really just like talking past each other about whatever group that they want to have envisioned. And like, the reason I brought this up is because I was doing that, and then all of a sudden I'm like, okay, cognitive bias is definitely influencing me. It's definitely blocking me from information. I'm going towards my own echo chamber. I realize that I'm holding these political positions because it's kind of nice. Like you start believing, like once you start associating with a group, you start taking in their ideas, you start consuming their readings and their information. All of a sudden you're like, wow, I have the truth of the world. You know, I hold the truth. Like it's like you start having like this beacon of light that I hold it, and now it's my job to persuade other people. But then I didn't realize is like, okay, now I don't want that truth to go away. I don't want the idea that my truth might be wrong. I might hold wrong information. I might not have it all figured out the way government should be formed. I might not have the best ideas of what justice is. Those type of things, I started realizing those. And then that's when what became really appealing is actually this a la carte idea where, you know what? I don't know shit. There's a lot that I need to learn. There's a lot that I want to discuss and figure out. And I'm not saying like everyone is going to go do this because it's just not the reality. But within the discourse, within the people having the discussions, I do possibly find interest because these are the people that are interested in it, people like yourself that maybe going away from those terms and choosing the more a la carte route almost, maybe we do start seeing those values actually do align and we start having the discussion about things such as like a policy, like, you know, what should the minimum wage be? What should foreign policy be? What should the tax system be? How should we fix income inequality? Those type of things. So like those are my thoughts on that. And like, maybe do you see, like I said, I know I'm an anecdotal example, but I do think there's something there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I guess the way that I would maybe push back against that a little bit is to think, all right, like I understand, you know, that like when you're hearing people argue about like, you know, what's real socialism, you know, what's real libertarianism or whatever, right? You know, that, you know, it's like that, you know, it's very like arguing about words is very tedious. You know, you want to, you know, I think there's a very healthy instinct to sort of say, let's not worry about the words. Let's argue about, you know, argue about the underlying ideas, right? Like Derek Parfit has a nice thing about this, and he's not talking about politics, but it's certainly applicable in his paper, The Unimportance of Personal Identity. You know, and he talks about like two different senses in which you could ask whether something, you know, whether you're going to be in pain under certain circumstances. He talks about somebody who's about to undergo a medical procedure, and they've never had to do this before, and they say, you know, will there be pain? And then, you know, will I be in pain? And then he talks about somebody who's about to go on a sea voyage, and they always get seasick every time, right? But they're interested in like whether seasickness counts as a kind of pain, right?
Right.
And they say, you know, well, will I be in pain, right? You know, and he sort of says, well, you know, we might use the same words, but like we're having two very different kinds of like, those are two very different kinds of questions, right? You know, one case, you know perfectly well what's going to happen, right? You're just wondering how to classify it, right? And the other, you're asking about what is going to happen. And it says that those, you know, those sort of higher order questions about like how to classify things only matter if the sort of lower order thing underlying it matters, right? You know, like it only matters, you know, like the fact that like if you decide seasickness counts as pain, right? You know, that'll, you know, you only have a reason to avoid that pain, you'll gain a new reason to avoid pain, right? You know, like you have just as much of a reason as you had before to avoid the seasickness. And I feel that, right? Like I sort of feel like, you know, if, you know, we should like rather than, you know, like rather than counting, you know, arguing about whether some particular way we could organize things would count as really real socialism, you know, if we could just like argue about like whether it would be better, you know, than what we have now. And if so, whether we can improve on that. Right. You know, And that makes sense. But I also think that there are, you know, if you're going to try to sort of reason about this stuff, it helps to have, you know, like pretty general, you know, pretty general goals that you care about, right? Sort of pretty general principles. You know, so you're not just sort of doing things in an ad hoc way. And I think that there's something like to sort of a way of kind of feeling the force of the other side of this, of saying, no, like it's good to be pretty consistent, you know, issue by issue, and sort of thinking about the way that a lot of the like mainstream media kind of discourse really valorizes you know, unpredictability, right? You know, being a maverick, whatever, you know, like, so if like if you you know, like you want to have you know, like if you want to get, you know, if you want to get your hot take piece published in Salon or Vox or whatever, and you say, like, you know, I'm a lifelong, you know, progressive liberal and I can't stand Trump, then, like, you know, that's not going to get published. But say, you know, right, I'm a lifelong Republican, and, you know, and I was the chair of the county Republican Party and I can't stand Trump, that they'll publish, right?
You know, yeah, you're right.
You know, because it's interesting, right? You know, because it's unpredictable. And there's a great, you know, there's a great Christopher Hitchens quote I've always loved from before he became a case in point of this, right? You know, but from an essay called Blunt Instruments that he wrote in the 80s, where he says that there's a sort of – that in the charmed circles of neoliberal, neoconservative journalism, you know, they really put a lot of premium on saying, you know, like, you know, being able to say, well, you know, I'm a lifelong liberal, but I say let's bomb the hell out of them, right? You know, but he really sort of cast derision on the idea that this is some sort of like point in your favor, right? He says if I didn't respond, you know, like all the topics that I write about, right? You know, like I want to, of course, think that I have original and interesting arguments, but I'd actually be alarmed, right, if somebody didn't basically know what I was going to, you know, what position I was going to take, right? If I was, you know, if my, you know, like if my knee didn't respond to a certain stimuli from, you know, from the doctor, you know, doing a test, I would be alarmed. You know, it's speaking of a loss of nerve, you know, that like this, that it's good. You know, there's a reason why we admire consistency and principles, and it seems it's not like at the very, you know, and it seems like the primary reason that there's this sort of media admiration for, mm-hmm. you know, oh, you know, he's an X, but he says Y, right? Is mostly that it moves eyeballs, it gets clicks, you know, that's, and there's something, you know, there's something I'm not crazy about, you know, about, you know, about that. So I do think there's something to be said for the consistent principles, which is not to say that I disagree with you, that it gets like really boring really fast, you know, hearing people argue about whether, you know, whether X counts as real Y-ism rather than just like, you know, rather than just arguing about whether X is a good idea.
Right. Yeah. And like I don't know how to phrase it, but like what I find kind of interesting as well is my motivation, I guess, for kind of thinking that maybe groups are an issue to some extent.
Yeah.
Is once I like kind of became more open to alternative political perspectives, uh-huh. and my like kind of skepticism, I guess you could say, is kind of why I've decided like I'm ready for the podcast to occasionally get into these political things and political discussions, is because I kind of do kind of keep it abstract and kind of make it more about, you know, figure it out for yourself and like don't take my political opinions because I don't know, you know what I mean? But what I like find interesting is maybe at least people can agree that these various political perspectives, various political groupings, we don't even necessarily need to talk about like their policy ideas all the time. I actually kind of find it interesting the various political groupings, what their critiques are, what they see as problems. It's like, for example, like libertarians, they believe that government power is dangerous and, you know, put in the wrong hands, it's too centralized. And the left makes good critiques and socialists make good critiques on capitalism. It creates income inequality. And, you know, people become kind of cogs in the machine. That's something I agree with. And I got to use like a conservative example. Maybe yeah. Conservatives have something to say about the need for a set of values that people align with, and it creates social cohesion or something like that. I don't know. I'm going off the top of my head.
Sure.
But the capitalists, for example, I think there is something to say about, maybe there is something good about the markets being efficient, creating innovation in some way. So these ideas that you can kind of like start picking and choosing, in the sense that, okay, what do they believe? What are they producing? And why do they think it's going to produce that? And why is that goal good? And kind of that point, in the sense that all of a sudden I feel like I became more open to the to various possibilities. And like I said, not everyone's going to do this, but the people that want to have the conversations, that want to start discussing these things, is there some benefit there in that sense?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm sure there is, some benefit there. And it's not even like, and it's not even a matter of everybody needs to sort of, stop having points of view on this stuff. So we can appreciate the sort of simplicity, total openness of being yanked around in all these directions. But but it's also useful, even if you are very committed to, particular point of view, to at least be able to do the mental exercise, right? You know, that you have why is it that, why is it that people who have this perspective, who have this perspective, like, what is the thing that they care about that's like sort of nudging them in this perspective? Because if you, certainly if you're interested in, even if you don't particularly think that, the truth lies somewhere in between or whatever, which like probably sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't, right?
Right, exactly.
But even if that's not like at the top of your level of interest, even if you're just interested in in persuading people, those people who can be persuaded, then it's still, you're going to be much more effective in doing that if you can at least like temporarily step aside from your perspective and think like, okay, what is it that really makes a libertarian tick or whatever, because otherwise you're just going to be directing arguments at them that just won't move somebody at all, right? Who has that perspective, because you're just saying that if they really cared about, because you're just essentially telling them that, if you start out with a left-wing, view of the world, and you're making left-wing assumptions, then here's how left-wing conclusions follow from them. And they know that, they don't care, right? That's not interesting, right? Whereas if you know what their assumptions are, then you can maybe think like, okay, well, how can I at least aim my pitch at an area where, you know, like a starting point that, you know, that like might actually mean something to them.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. And yeah. And like the other motivation, I guess, is, and this is like to kind of conclude the conversation and steer in this direction. Something I find fascinating with all sides that even like when they get down to like the issues and stuff like that, I find it interesting how many people I find that kind of like justify their political positions based on some, and this is where I kind of want your thoughts. Cause I think I remember reading this in your book. So this perception of human nature, like for example, to bring up libertarians again, cause they're kind of like an easy example, but like libertarians, they believe that human nature, people are self-interested, right? And that self-interest, that, you know, a peer capitalist system, free market system, system of property rights that promotes people's self-interest, creates a more efficient system, creates more innovation, blah, 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 blah. You know, the list goes on and on, right? And then, but then I also hear a lot of times, like the people on the left use a very similar perception of human nature, like, oh, humans are self-interested. Therefore, we need to halt capitalism because, you know, we don't want a self-interested system that just promotes self-interest and then people are left on the wayside. And that's when you create income inequality and you create crony capitalism and stuff like that. So my question is do you think that sometimes people rely too much? This is like the concluding question. Do you think people rely on human nature too much to justify their positions? And because the reason I bring that up is because although we're constantly finding stuff out about human nature, science has given us evidence and all that. I think at the end of the day, especially it's like kind of like it. I don't know if this is like a right example to use. It's not like the is out problem, but it's like people are trying to take what is. What we know about human nature, what science is telling us about human nature, and then people try to extract a lot of various like values from that about human nature that, oh, therefore my political positions are right because look at this is what human nature is. When really human nature, from what I think what we know about it, it's very moldable, changeable. People can kind of alter their sense of like what human nature is. My point is it's very culturally influenced. And I think people discount that. So kind of what are your thoughts on that and its relation to politics just because they're constantly connected?
Yeah. I think that the idea that that human nature, you know, is very self-interested, therefore capitalism, you know, is good, has always, you know, sort of struck me very oddly, and I've often been very frustrated with what seems to be the very common kind of socialist response to that, which is just to sort of say, well, a lot of the things you were saying at the end of your answer, right? You know, human nature is malleable, right? Mm-hmm. It changes based on circumstances, all of which I'm sure is true, right? Like, it's, you know, definitely true, you know, to a point, right? That they, and if you're sort of obviously if you're having, you know, one of the frustrating things about this debate is that like it's very hard, you know, if you're relating human, you know, to talk discussions about human nature to discussions about politics, it's very hard for that not to like really like flatten out what you're saying about the first part, because like, and you know, there's nothing like sort of, you know, because like obviously anything that's like a view about like what humans are like that you could fit into a sentence is going to be like a weird oversimplification, right? You know, that's
agreed.
You know, so you know, that obviously, you know, that we can say various things that we know, you know, about, you know, based on psychology and, you know, neuroscience and, you know, whatever, about how, you know, how people tend to act in various circumstances that are, you know, that like that superficially conform to like different, like kind of really simplified views you could have about it. And, you know, I mean, I guess the, I mean, one, if you were going to do the one sentence thing, you know, I guess I'd go with, you know, dip back into Hume one more time at the end of the conversation, you know, and he's got this great essay, called On the Immortality of the Soul, which, is not one of the more like commented on, essays, but is really good. And, one of the things, one of his objections in that essay to the idea of heaven and hell is pretty much, if you ever watched the TV show, The Good Place, in the first season of it, especially the main character, you know, Christabel's character is constantly saying, why isn't there a medium place? Right. And this is basically, and you know, Hugh, one of the points Hugh makes there, right. He says, if you were going to, go around the world trying to separate the righteous from the wicked, so you could give the righteous a good supper, the wicked a good beating, then you, that it'd be, really difficult to figure out who is who. He said, the more you learn about people, the harder it would be to classify them. He says, most of us float between vice and virtue. So I mean, like, most of us float between vice and virtue is like probably like the most reasonable thing you can say in one sentence about human nature. But sort of take it a step to the side from like what's actually true about human nature and thinking about like, okay, let's ask a slightly different question, which is, to the extent that you're worried about the cruel and selfish aspects of human nature,
right?
What should follow from that politically, right? What sort of political consequences, you know, come out of that? And this is where I get really frustrated, because you know, because there's, I think, a sort of long tradition of socialists kind of taking the bait on this and sort of assuming that what they have to argue is that human nature isn't so bad, right? You know,
right,
so
right.
It's like, oh, no, it's okay, right? You know, it's, you know, we don't have to have this really selfish system like capitalism, because, mm-hmm. you know, humans can be kind and, you know, generous and cooperative. But I think actually a more interesting and plausible response is to say, I mean, not that it's not true that, you know, sure, I mean, like, yeah, to some extent, under some circumstances, we're kind and cooperative. To some extent, under some circumstances, we're selfish jerks, right? Like,
right.
It's all incredibly complicated. But to the extent that you worry about us being selfish jerks, that actually strikes me not as a reason to think that the economic status quo is fine, but, you know, as a reason to think it's not fine, right? You know, mm-hmm. that, like, if you have that, you know, that – under capitalism, you know, the most people have very little realistic choice except for to go to work for those people who do, through whatever combination of skill and luck and circumstances, right, you know, have the capacity to own their own businesses. And and that's a massive amount of power that gives some people over others, right? And that, I mean, there's a, you know, think, I mean, that's, this is, once, if somebody holds your livelihood in their hands, right, you know, they have a tremendous amount of power over you. And so that strikes me as, I mean, of course, it's not a reason to reject capitalism in favor of, like, you know, Soviet style one party, you know, state socialism, because there you have the same problem, right? You know, mm-hmm. they like, it's also very hierarchical, but like, that seems like it gives us a good reason to try to have a much, much more egalitarian and less hierarchical economic system, because to the extent that you worry about that, we can argue about what extent that should be, but to the extent that you worry about that, then that strikes me as a good reason not to trust people with the amount of one-sided power they have over another, you know, in those kinds of systems.
Right. Yeah, and I basically agree with that. It's just, I always found it interesting how quickly people want to like oversimplify it with just their stance on human nature. And I don't know, that's why I want to at least bring it up to conclude. But yeah, I think that's a good kind of endpoint to the conversation. So yeah, I'm going to end the recording here.
All right. Awesome.